I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome to the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today we're doing takeaways from the 2024 Masters. Later on, we'll be joined by Andy Johnson and Shane Bacon for their takeaways. But in the meantime, Scottie Scheffler is your champion, and he completely outclassed the field on Sunday. It was an astounding display of strategy, ball striking, short game, even at times putting. This is Scottie's second major and second green jacket. And it's hard not to project that many more major titles will be coming his way, though we should know from recent experience that nothing is guaranteed. Nonetheless, how can anyone beat Scottie Scheffler when he's playing like this? That's one of the big questions that I and my co-host, Joseph LaMagna, will be tackling today. But first, we're going to do our traditional in and out segment, where we talk about what we're in on and what we're out on this week. Joseph, what are you in on?
Garrett, I am in on the heightened emotions of championship golf and a lot of the moments that that provides. Guys are clearly on edge when they're playing majors, especially when the conditions are tough. It was super windy out there. It was exhausting. There were a lot of bogeys. There were a lot of worse than bogey. And you saw some quite entertaining moments that made their way onto social media. I think you were particularly tickled by the Zach Johnson telling the patrons at Augusta to F off.
I mean, I loved it. And the press conference was even funnier.
But those are the kinds of things that happen at major championships, right? Phil at Shinnecock. I mean, Zach Johnson at Shinnecock. You get these outbursts from players that we don't see week in and week out. And maybe some of that is the increased purse sizes and guys being a little bit more comfortable this year with all the money that's flown in, that's flooded into professional golf. But we don't see outbursts very often. There were quite a few of them over the past few days. And I just think the heightened emotions that come with championship golf, it's something that I relish. So I'm in on that.
Yeah. And I think that the splitting of the main men's professional golf leagues has placed an increased intensity and focus on the majors. And so I think that we're going to see that more and more, where this kind of pent-up energy is being saved for these four moments in the year, you know?
Garrett, what are you in on?
I'm going to slip in two here, but the first one really quick. I'm in on Tiger Woods shaking Vern Lundquist's hand behind the 16th green on Sunday and saying a few words. Loved that. Got me a little teared up. You know, it's just a great moment. And if you haven't seen it, you listeners out there, go look it up somewhere. Just do a Google search or a Twitter search or something and find that moment between those two legends.
On X and presumably Instagram, ESPN posted a very cool video of that.
Yes. Yeah. A little closer up and you got a sense for the conversation. Wonderful. The main thing I'm in on is Bryson DeChambeau's new and improved attitude. Like, this week, he was great. He answered all the questions from the media good-naturedly, even when those questions seemed to be aimed at eliciting some kind of reaction from him. He's still a goofball, but kind of in charming ways. He's not nearly as whiny and petulant on the course as I've seen him, and he struggled at times this weekend. Maybe I just missed those parts, but I didn't see it as much. He was expressing gratitude to the fans on a consistent basis. Now, a couple of caveats. Putting on this kind of performance in the limelight for a few weeks a year is easier than doing it week in, week out on the PGA Tour. Like right now, he is less in the spotlight than he was before, unless you're really following Liv closely, I suppose. But even that, it seems like there's not as much scrutiny on what the players are doing. And so that's one thing. And the other caveat is, of course, I'm still not a fan of the LIV affiliation or anything like that. I'm not, this is not an endorsement of him or that choice, but I just enjoyed him this week. And I thought that he showed something different, and he showed, you know, the Bryson that was in there that I suspected I would enjoy, the kind of goofy, fun Bryson. He just showed that this week, as opposed to having that kind of layer of darkness over him.
Garrett, I got close to writing this up. Like, I think, and curious for how you feel about this, I think Bryson DeChambeau is one of the most earnest and honest golfers in professional golf. Now, I think he's respectfully, like, kind of an idiot, and a lot of the things he's earnest and honest about are quite misguided, but I genuinely think that he believes everything he's saying to his core. Like, one of his answers to one of the questions that was posed in one of his post rounds at the Masters was something around him being divisive. And he was like, you know, I don't think I'm divisive at all. And he means that. Like, I don't think he even realizes some of the decisions he's made and like how it has been divisive. And when he's talking about golf courses, like, he fully believes what he's doing is correct. And I mean, I disagree with a lot of what Bryson says, right? Especially around equipment. But he does believe it, and there's something refreshing about his candor.
Joseph, what are you out on?
I am out on the death of the importance of making the cut. And with so much changing in the professional golf landscape, you have the LIV Tour, 54 holes, no cut events. And this is not a shot at LIV, because the PGA Tour, in reforming its product, many of the signature events now do not have cut lines. And so we have lost the historical significance of top players going on these cut streaks. And I think we were reminded this past weekend, with Tiger Woods making his 24th consecutive cut at the Masters, what a cut streak represents. I think they're meaningful. I think it shows that you made the weekend, you battled, maybe you were a couple off the cut line, you fought your way back. And that is now context that is going to be missing from the historical record at 95% of professional golf events, because cut streaks, you're just not going to be able to say anymore, hey, Xander Schauffele has made, you know, 35 cuts in a row, because so many of those events are non-cut events. But the Masters, in preserving its history and tradition, that's going to be one of the few places that you can say, like, there's a cut streak here, and I think it's significant. So it's sort of being in on the significance of making the cut and out on how we've kind of changed that in a lot of ways in professional golf.
That's the nature of in and out. You can switch it around like that. Yeah, I mean, Tiger at this point in his career seems to have about 36 holes to give. And I'm really glad that there was a cut line drama for him to engage in, because even if he was saying, my intention, my only goal is to win this tournament, the cut clearly mattered, and he really put forth a monumental effort this week on those first 2 days to make the cut. He played some great golf, and then he was pretty exhausted after that, obviously, and did not play well on the weekend. But I'm glad that there was some intermediate goal for him to strive toward. All right, so what I'm out on, I'm going the architecture direction here. I'm out on the second hole remaining a par 5.
Okay.
I think Augusta National should be a par 71. Now, they're never going to do this, but, you know, here's why I think this. All of the changes to that hole, including moving back the tee this year and pressing it to the left, have been to protect the par of 5 on that hole. And in the case of the second hole, these changes have not made the hole better. You know, before that, a good half century ago, they put that bunker in. They had the club had George Cobb put in the bunker on the right side of the fairway, changing the nature of the hole a bit. They grew in the trees from the left side. All of this was done, again, to protect a par 5 that was vulnerable to scoring pretty early in its history. And I would argue that these changes haven't improved the hole. In the case of 8, 13, and 15, the other par 5s at Augusta National, I think those holes are better as par 5s because the layups on those holes are really interesting. to me, the layup on the second hole isn't quite as interesting. Yeah, you want to position yourself well for a right versus a left hole location, but it's nothing like what you get on 8, 13, and 15 in terms of like a really interesting layup zone in terms of terrain and angles and all of that. So I want those other par fives to remain par fives, and lengthening those holes is meaningful and makes them more interesting. In the case of number two, I don't think any of this has improved the hole. I think it would be a terrific long par four. And if they were to clear out some of the trees on the left, maybe even take out that bunker on the right, maybe look at restoring the original green on that hole, which was very different and kind of preferred an approach from the left side of the fairway as opposed to the right, I think you'd have a great par four. Now, do I think par matters? Do I think they could do all of this and keep it a par five? I would be fine with that, but the club probably wouldn't be fine with that. So I think that changing the par of the hole would allow them, would free them up just to let that hole be what it wants to be.
Okay, so I think what I was having trouble with as you started to unpack that take a little bit was parsing out the ways, the distinction of par and if that matters at all versus improving the hole. And it sounds to me like your emphasis would be on improving the hole. Like you don't like the way that it plays right now. It's not interesting versus if you just flipped it from a five to a four, you don't solve that problem. So fundamentally, you would like to see that bunker removed to increase the width there and give people more options, and it just plays better under those conditions. It doesn't play better because there's a four on the card instead of a five. Do I have that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah. The point would not be to change the par. The point would be to free up the club to stop making these changes that don't improve the hole. All right. So Joseph and I, in a second, are going to do some takeaways from the tournament of our own before bringing on Andy Johnson and Shane Bacon for their segments. But first, let's talk a little bit about Echo Golf Shoes. The latest shoe from Echo Golf is the LT1. This is a sneaker-style modern design. And what I like about Echo is that they always have something new up their sleeves with their designs. This year, the LT1 features LYTR foam. You might pronounce that lighter foam, which is this advanced bounce and rebound material that you'll find embedded in the sole of the shoe. What you really need to know about this stuff is that it's very flexible, very comfortable, and makes walking 18 holes much easier than it would be otherwise. You can also wear the LT1 in some serious weather because the leather upper is waterproof, not to mention very soft and durable. And finally, the Echo LT1 is available in both laced and BOA options, so whatever you prefer there. You know, when it comes to golf shoes, quality really matters. If you get a substandard or just average shoe, you're going to need to replace it fairly soon. Golf shoes take a beating. But with Echo, you get real quality, real durability, and a shoe that's going to hold up against all the walking and the weather you can throw at it. And that's why players like Lydia Ko, Erik van Rooyen, and Henrik Stenson wear this shoe. So shop the Echo LT1 and other Echo products at echo.com. All right, Joseph, before bringing on Andy and Shane, let's do a couple of high-level takeaways of our own from this Masters. What do you have right off the bat?
Tell you what, Garrett, I think there's been a true changing of the guard. And one of my big takeaways from watching this Masters is that there are certain names we always associate with playing super well at the Masters. And I think there are a couple new sheriffs in town. We always think about Jordan Spieth as the Augusta specialist. And I don't mean to kick him while he's down, but missed the cut, wasn't competitive this week. Entering the 2024 Masters, of players who had played at least 8 rounds at Augusta since the start of 2021, the top two names coming into this tournament by strokes gained per round were Will Zalatoris at number one and Scottie Scheffler at number two. Those golfers yet again finished in the top 10. Obviously, Scottie won. Will Zalatoris finished tied for ninth. As we think about Augusta specialists, some of those names who we've often associated with greatness here, again, like Spieth, like a Jason Day, some of those names, I think we need to start thinking about Scottie Scheffler and Will Zalatoris as the true Augusta specialists. And I'm really excited to see what they can do in future editions of the Masters. I mean, those are going to be guys that are staples of the top 10. So that was one of my big takeaways.
I want to get into Scottie Scheffler a little bit, but first tell me about Will Zalatoris. Why is he in this category?
Well, coming into this Masters, he had the single best strokes gained per round at Augusta. He's only appeared here twice, finished in the top 10 both times, gaining almost 3 strokes per round at Augusta. And he just finished 9th again. He's one of the truly great iron players of this era. At least he has been so far in his career. And he's shown that he's really comfortable on these greens, especially with the lag putting, which is I'm not going to say it's an underrated skill at Augusta. I think it's pretty appropriately thought of, but Will Zalatoris can handle those shots. And he's shown a lot of touch with a short game here too. Hits it plenty long off the tee. He's going to be somebody who's doing well. And he's now played here 3 times, 3 top tens. Really impressive. And then obviously Scotty, he's already won here twice now. So I think it's well established that Scottie Scheffler is really good here, but I think the Zalatoris storyline may go a little bit under the radar and people will throw around Spieth and some of these other names, but it's probably Will Zalatoris that you need to be talking about in that spot.
Yeah, that's a good find there, because I think I noticed that he did well in his past couple of Masters, but maybe not as well as he actually did. Now, when it comes to Scottie, obviously an Augusta master already, what do you think it is about his game that suits him so well to this course? If you were to like identify one or two things.
Garrett, I'll keep this as succinct as possible, but I think a very powerful and underrated topic in golf is like the conditional tense. The if this happens, how do you handle it? And if this happens, how do you handle it? Almost like if you're a computer programmer, you're kind of used to thinking about this. Like if the user clicks on this function, here's how it responds. If there's an error, here's how we handle it. And in golf, especially at Augusta National, there's a strong relationship between your iron play and your short game. If I execute this iron shot, here's where it's going to end up, and I'm going to have a 12-footer or 18-footer for birdie. If I don't, then I need to have the short game to get me out of that situation. And what's fascinating to me is the one player that I heard articulate this is Bryson DeChambeau. Over the weekend, I don't know if you heard this, but he said Augusta National is an intellectual golf course. It's a lot of if-then-else statements. And it's really interesting to me to hear somebody articulate it that way. It's definitely a way that I've long thought about golf. And I think to answer your question, Scottie Scheffler has those if-else questions answered. He's an elite ball striker. He hits it far, and he's magical short game. You can get away with some sloppy short range putting at Augusta. A lot of poor putters have had success there. But if I had to boil it down, that would be a somewhat succinct way of putting it.
You know, I was thinking back on his round and trying his round today on Sunday. Thinking back on that round and trying to figure out how many mistakes he made. And I came down on he was a bit short with his iron on one, but he was short right, which is kind of the good miss on
that. He wasn't going long.
He was never going long, which I saw quite a few players do to that back left pin position today, and that's dead back there. You can't do anything. All right. So that was a mistake, but it was kind of a good mistake. Then he was in the fairway bunker on two, which is, again, you know, it's like not ideal, but it's not the worst mistake in the world. You just kind of get it out of the bunker and then you have an approach shot, and he ultimately made par. He wasn't striking the ball super well right at the beginning. I don't think he hit that approach very well. I forget exactly what happened with it. In any case, then he was long on four. That was a mistake. That was like his one bad position on the hole. But I don't think that he was ever making double bogey from back there, really. Like, he hit kind of a middling chip, was short with it, and two-putted, and it didn't really feel like he was in major threat of making double bogey. Then he was short with an iron on seven, I guess. I can't really think of any other mistakes, like major mistakes particularly, in his round. And from that point on, I mean, he was conspicuously awesome. And so, like, what is it about Scottie Scheffler that allows him to get through a round like that at Augusta National of all places? And I think it's what you're talking about there, that ability, that the if then else, and those answers to those questions.
And it should not go without saying that Scottie understands golf courses. He understands where you can't miss and then takes it out of play and is unbelievable at executing on his intended strategy. And then if he misfires, he's still going to be in a spot that's fine. And then he's got the short game to get himself out of that situation. So I do think it's worth calling out that we've talked a lot about Scottie's course management. Now it's become a hot topic, but like, he just has this innate understanding of how to play golf courses.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to do my takeaway fairly briefly, but this is a takeaway really about the kind of position of the Masters in the popular golf consciousness, like its stature as a tournament. The Masters has not been all that competitive recently, if you judge competitive by how close the contenders are to each other at the very end of the tournament. The last time we had a playoff in the Masters was 2017, Justin Rose and Sergio Garcia. 2018, Patrick Reed won by one shot over Ricky Fowler, so that was pretty close, but Ricky kind of made a charge on the back nine, and so for a lot of that day, it wasn't really that, it didn't feel that close. 2019, Tiger was ahead by two going into the 72nd hole and was able to play for bogey. 2020, Dustin Johnson ran away with it. 2021, Hideki, ahead by two going into the final hole, able to play for bogey. 2022, Scottie was able to four-putt and still win by three. 2023, Rahm won by four. And this year, Scottie pretty much had a stranglehold on the tournament from Amen Corner forward. So, hasn't been... like, there haven't been, you know, huge fireworks on Sunday at the Masters recently. And yet, in that time, it seems like the Masters has only grown in popularity, grown in prestige, grown in stature, which I think is a tribute to the sheer quality of the tournament's execution. Its golf course, everything about what they do on site, everything they allow to happen with the telecast, it is the quality of the product and not necessarily the competitiveness of the final day that has made this tournament become more and more important and feel like more and more of an event over time.
To the first point, very low variance golf course, and it allows talent to separate. So I actually don't think that, like, we may have more blowouts, and it's going to let the best golfers in the world perform well. Maybe that won't lead to the most exciting finishes, but it is going to let the best golfers in the world win, just like we saw with Scottie. But I think what you're hitting on is a really interesting point. We've had so many arguments about golf courses, and they're good because they produce a particular leaderboard or because they produce an exciting finish. And I don't think that's the right way to think about the quality of a tournament. It should be the quality of the golf, and nobody does that better than Augusta National. So it's an interesting point. I like that takeaway.
All right, we're going to bring on Andy Johnson in a second here for his main takeaway from this Masters. But first, a word about Club Champion. Club Champion helps golfers of any skill level play better golf through custom-fitted and custom-built equipment. They've got extensively trained master fitters to help you out. These master fitters use an in-depth, data-driven, tour-level fitting process. They've got 65,000 hittable head and shaft combos at their disposal, including all of the new 2024 brands. 120-plus studios nationwide, so not really hard to find a Club Champion location. They've got industry-leading technology like TrackMan to record your data in real time. Club Champion's fittings produce real results for every level of player. This includes 20 extra yards off the tee on average. They've also got a perfect fit guarantee. So if you get a Club Champion custom built club and you don't see what you saw in the hitting bay, you can go back within 90 days and get your clubs adjusted so that they perform how you expect them to. So for Fried Egg listeners, here is the deal that Club Champion is offering. Right now, you can use the code Fried Egg, that's all one word, Fried Egg, to get 50% off the cost of your fitting with the purchase of a club. So go to clubchampion.com and book your fitting today. Again, that's code FRIEDEGG, all one word. All right, we are here with Andy Johnson himself, founder of the Fried Egg, and one of our on the site reporters here at the Masters. How's it going?
It's great. It's such a long week, and it is. You're so happy to be there. It is a lot of work. You're a lot of days on site, lots of days trucking around. I think, like, you know, as a media member who spent a lot of time on the golf course, you do feel the physicality of Augusta National. I think it's like it is maybe one of the underrated features of Augusta National. One of the great architects of the Golden Age, William Flynn, used to always write about how he believed that a golf course should be a physical test as well as, you know, a test of golf skill and many other things. But the physicality of Augusta National is no joke. And at the end of the week, you stand up and you feel it in your legs.
Do you think that, like, that's going to change the way you approach your preparation for Augusta National each year and be getting on the stair stepper, and, you know, the same way that Tiger Woods limps?
This man ran a marathon. I know.
I ran a marathon 5 weeks ago, so I think I was prepared for it.
So you're doing a little bit better than Tiger with walking the hills out there, in other words.
Yeah. I am doing better than him. It's crazy how it's like seemingly like a two-round governor with Tiger at this point, where he goes out and he shoots even par for two rounds, and then it's just like the wheels. I understand why, but it's crazy to me that it's just like two rounds, you know? And he shoots these scores and he makes the cut, and you're like, I mean, like, on Friday, it wasn't crazy. I don't think Tiger wasn't out of contention on Friday. Like, he would have been a long shot, but you had to think that the people at plus one had a shred of chance if they played a great weekend. Yeah. I mean, that's insane to me that then it's not insane. It's just, you know, it's just a crazy era of Tiger. And I don't know if four rounds is really in the cards anymore. And I think it's like, it's not unfair to ask that question.
You know what it kind of makes me excited for in a weird way is TGL. Because, I mean, my interest in golf that's not on a golf course is fairly limited. But to the extent that I'm interested in it, I'm interested to see Tiger hit golf shots without needing to walk the course. I think that could be really interesting, because he proves every time he makes the cut at the Masters on one leg, or maybe like a half a leg, that he can still hit wonderful golf shots. That's not really the question. The question is, how much can his body bear in between shots?
Hey, do you think that makes you a Jupiter Lynx fan?
You know, I'm going to have to learn the names of the teams, because the only one I know at this point is the Boston Ballfrogs. And I know there's a New York team with legendary New Yorker Xander Schauffele on it, but otherwise completely ignorant. So I'm going to have to figure out my affiliation. Maybe we can do a podcast about that. Why don't we get into some stuff here? Let's get into into one of your big overarching takeaways, Andy, and see where it goes from there.
I know you guys have already talked about Scotty, but it's hard for that not to be the overarching takeaway. I think, like, my biggest takeaway is, I get they're intertwined. We'll do like the golf course. I think, like, everybody, we obsess over this idea that Augusta National is this, you know, we talk about for weeks leading in, what's the trait that you need at Augusta National? Approach play. It's this. And at the end of the day, what you need at Augusta National is you need to be really good at everything. Because over the course of 72 holes, especially this week in the firmness, and with the firmness, the pace of the golf course, and just how unrelenting it was for these guys, you have to be without weakness, because that golf course, just as soon as you're uncomfortable, it preys on it. And it's an amazing golf course in the sense that you have these shots that are ridiculously hard, and you know they're ridiculously hard, but the only way to accomplish them is to swing without fear, without anything in your head, any clutter in your head. And I think Scotty, it's just like amazing to see how many fairways he hits. Like, he's always in play off the tee, seemingly. He's the best iron player in the world right now. I don't think it's a stretch to say that he's, you know, in the top three or four in short game. And the only thing that's a little bit shaky is the putter, which has been a lot better since he switched to a mallet. And I think, like, you go out there, and I think the players know that Scotty's better than them. I think the players all the way up to the very, very best players in the world know that Scotty Scheffler's the best player in the world right now. And I don't think we've really been here. We've been in this place since Tiger Woods. Whereas, you know, and I think, like, Rory probably had it in 2014. I think that's one place that we had it. But other than that, we haven't seen this, where I think other players in the locker room, like elite players, top 15 players, know that Scotty Scheffler's better at golf than them.
Andy, I don't know how much time you spent in Scotty Scheffler's group over the past few days, but one thing that stands out to me about Scotty kind of goes along with his mindset and how he thinks about a lot of things and just controlling what he can control. But Scotty seems to flush bad shots out of his memory so quickly and follow up a bad shot with something that's just flawlessly executed. It kind of goes to what you're saying. If you're uncomfortable and things can unravel on you, Scotty doesn't let that happen. He followed up a bad bogey on 7 with a string of birdies over his next 9 holes. Curious if you saw any moments from him where you thought, like, well, maybe there's a crack in the foundation here, and then he just followed it up by flushing a shot, because I feel like that's the story of Scotty Scheffler the last 4 days.
I thought the moment was on Saturday, after he made a double on 10, and, you know, it was kind of shaky there. He bogeyed, was it 11 also? So he went double and then bogey, and it kind of looked like he was escorting himself out of the tournament. And then, you know, he missed the green on 12, and it's like, okay, like, this guy's on the ropes. And it, you know, I think part of this is that nobody took the ball and ran. You know, I think, like, everybody was kind of stuck in neutral. That was there. The only person moving up the leaderboard on Saturday was Morikawa. But, like, Homa was kind of stuck, and Ludwig obviously moved up. Homa was stuck. Bryson was going backwards. Like, and Scotty's in the spot, and then, you know, he rolls in an eagle putt. I mean, he rolls in a 25-footer for eagle, and it's like, oh, never mind, he's back. it's just, you know, there was an air of inevitability on Thursday. I mean, you walk around the media center, and people are like, this tournament's already over, because they see him there. And I think that is starting to circulate in the locker room. And that's very Tiger-like. I don't think you could say this. He's not, people are going to rush to say, like, he's the next Tiger. A young patron was telling me this. And I'm like, well, you know, Scotty's a lot older than when Tiger started doing this. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily, like, fair to call him that, you know, this much in. But I think there's, like, a real Tiger-like quality, because, like, listen, like, he made that run, and it was a tie ball game. Everybody had a good chance. And he makes this run, he makes 3 birdies, and then, like, within minutes of each other, everybody falls apart.
That's the thing, is that, you know, yes, unbelievably dominant, sheerly competent performance from Scotty Scheffler on Sunday. And competent, I'm not using as, like, you know, faint praise or anything. His game was just so together. And yet, he did bogey the 11th hole. He did hit a couple of squirrely irons on the first couple of holes. There was a window. right?
The 11th hole was masterful, though. He hit the approach exactly where he, you know, you just watched two of the last four, the two of the four competitors that had a shot hit it the one place you can't hit it on that hole. Scotty hit it exactly where he was aiming. Like, I'm convinced that he hit it exactly where he was looking, because that ball ended in a spot that there was no possible realm of outcomes that he was going to walk away with more than worse than a five.
Yeah. Yeah. But in any case, it was a bogey. He didn't get up and down from there. But basically, as soon as he walked off the 11th green, everybody else had backed up three or four steps. You know, Scotty may have backed up one step on 11, very tough hole, understandable to do that. But then all around him, Morikawa in the pond, Åberg before him in the pond, Homa on 12 over the green in the bushes. So people kind of cleared the space for him. And from that point on, it was just like there was no chance, right? Did you get the impression, Andy, that when you were on site, by the time Scotty Scheffler was walking out of Amen Corner, that it was just over? Like there was no chance.
I mean, the way he put the gas pedal down was super impressive and didn't give up. I will say, to me, it's something stood out on Sunday that the second most complete player in contention was Ludvig. He seems to be, like, to me, one of the players that could match Scotty. Colin Morikawa in his post round presser, just scrum, the little quick quotes area. He kind of talked about how Scotty's just better than him. You know, it was very revealing, the quotes, you know, about how he's hitting less clubs, how he's so good, like his short game's so good. And I think, like, to me, the person that was up for the task, and I don't think it was a mistake, I think it was just a bad swing that cost him, was Ludvig.
Do you want to talk about Åberg a little bit? Because, you know, I think he's the other big story. How much golf did you watch from Ludvig this week?
I watched a good amount today. And I think that's, like, obviously, I mean, you're talking about a guy that last year was playing, I think, in the Thunderbird, the ASU tournament this weekend. And now I'm not sure exactly where in the world rankings he's going to go. I'm assuming he's going to be about six or so. He's seventh in the world rankings, and he's made his debut at a course that's been very, very difficult for players to debut at. He makes his major and masters debut and finishes second, solo second. It was pretty unbelievable. I think, like, we have a tendency in the media of heaping, like, unrealistic expectations on people, and I think that's going to happen with Ludvig, but maybe he's ready for it. And the golf swing seems so simple. The short game looks tidy. The putting stroke looks good. And I think this is just going to be more, though, of what's coming, to be completely honest. I think there's so much talent in the young ranks of golf, that we're going to see more and more players like Ludvig.
On that, not to jump around too much, but to go back to Scotty for a second, this is the most confident I've been in a player to rack up more major championship trophies over the next 5 years than, like, anybody in recent memory. But at the same time, the history of golf is that anytime you feel that way, like, it always ends up proving you wrong and golfers fall apart. Like, that, it just happens. I mean, Andy, where are you on, like, the certainty of Scheffler's career? Because there's so many lessons that we should be cautious with this. But I'm like, I think Scotty's going to win two more green jackets.
So since 2022, Phoenix, he's won five PGA Tour events. Just, like, you know, a couple signature events. I think there's a playoff event in there. So he won two Arnold Palmers, a Waste Management that had a stacked field. And then I think he won another playoff event, but then he has two players and two masters in that time. If I was going to say it, like, set an over under, if I said 5.5 majors, what side of it would you take?
It's such recency bias, but I'm so tempted to take I'm pretty tempted to take the over on that. And I know that that's the side that I shouldn't take, but I think Scottie's going to win at least one more Masters. I feel confident in that. And to get three more somewhere else feels very reasonable to me. How about you, Garrett?
I never know what to say to these questions because there are so many examples of predicting that players are going to win a certain amount of majors that now seem utterly ridiculous in retrospect. And maybe that's the point of an exercise like this, to create some tape that can be used later and be laughed at. Yeah, just jam me up, you know? But yeah, I mean, I feel like he's heading towards the over. Like, doesn't it feel like Scottie Scheffler should be headed towards a Tom Watson type major record? Kind of, at least. Doesn't it feel like his form, his game is more impressive than Brooks Koepka's?
What would you take?
Doesn't it feel like he's a more complete player than Rory McIlroy? I don't know. This is all, we're living in our current moment. Back in 2014, it felt like Rory was going to win 10 majors, that he was the heir apparent. He was the guy after Tiger, and it hasn't worked out that way, at least so far. He's got some time left. But yeah, I mean, have we had a player, even Rory, in the midst of his 2014 run, have we had a player like Scottie where when he starts rolling before the tournament, you're saying, I don't think anybody but Scottie's going to win this?
Yeah, I'm going to take the under because
there's no danger in it.
Well, it's just hard.
Yeah.
When you're talking about winning six majors, he's at two. And it's not like getting to two's been easy for him. You know, the thing that gives you reason for it is that he's never not going to be around. I think he's played 15 majors since 2020. So, like, you know, not like that's, we're at almost 4 years, or we're at 4+ years of majors, 15 majors, and he's got 10 top tens. So, like, you know, he's going to be there 66% of the time. He's finishing top 10 in majors. So he's going to be there, but winning these is really hard. And there are like breaks that go along the way with winning these. And, you know, I just think about like the start to the tournament, how his ball stayed on that bank. And he chips and he holes a bunker shot on 12. If that ball doesn't hit the cup, and I know it did, if that ball doesn't hit the cup, it's a bogey. And he makes probably another bogey. And that's literally four shots. He has this amazing way, and this could be just a knack. The other day on Saturday, he started. He didn't hit any good shots the first three holes, and he was 2 under, except for like a putt. You know, he holed a chip shot off the green on 1 for birdie. And then he makes like a 25-footer on 2. And somehow it's almost Jordan Spieth-like. And this is why I think like the short game just doesn't get talked about as much as it should. It's always about the irons, and well-deserved. Like, he's a great iron player. But what won him the tournament, where he played these three-hole stretch to start Saturday, somehow he played it 2 under, despite not hitting good golf shots. And then on Thursday, you talk about the stretch of 12 and 13, when he hit some kind of shaky shots. He played so good that day, but he hit a couple loose shots. And it's like most players get through that and they're 2 over on that stretch. He got really lucky by that ball not going in the water. But like most players are two over through that stretch. He's 2 under. Like, he just has this. It's the same thing when you go back to that Masters win 2 years ago when he chipped in on 3. Like, he just has, beyond all the skills, he just has a way with the moment. You know, whenever it feels like it's on the ropes, he does something miraculous. Today, I really thought, like, he wasn't playing great. And then he hit that rope hook on 8, and it just started this run, that 8, 9, and 10 run that just was like, that just set up the win.
Yeah, I mean, Scottie Scheffler certainly seems to have a knack for winning golf tournaments when he's in contention. It's hard to think of many tournaments that he's kind of pissed away. But, you know, he's emerging as one of these historically great players at Augusta National, potentially, or a generationally great player at Augusta National. And this brings up the subject of the course itself, right? You referred to this a bit earlier, Andy. I wonder if you want to expand on your thoughts a little bit about what you saw at Augusta National this week from the golf course. This is probably the best version of it that you've seen on site, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of the last time we had Augusta National firm. You know, it's been kind of plagued by rain. We've had like a firm day here, a firm day there. I mean, this year we got like three really firm days. I think Thursday was fairly firm too. And obviously you had the wind. You had like a great mixture of wind, weather, and then today you had the ability for people to go out and make some birdies. It still was so hard. I just think that this golf course, when it's firm, it has the, I mean, there's nowhere to hide out there. It is, we romanticize the McKenzie and some of the stuff that they've lost over time with renovations that have been geared towards championship play. But it shows like what a golf course that has great bones, has the financial means can do to stay relevant with technology. And there's only really one place that can do this. But this golf course, to me, I after seeing it this week, I don't think there's anything that like is even close as good of a test as this place.
That was a big takeaway for me, Andy. So the winner was at 11 under, right? And second place was at 7 under. We had a golf course that's been lengthened so many times over the years. They unveiled a new tee box on number 2 this year. Last year, it was number 13 that had been lengthened a bunch. Like, the only place in the world you can do this is at Augusta National, and how the resources, the wealth they have to put this together. The takeaway, I don't think, should be like, see, professional golf is in a great spot right now. We don't need to roll the ball back. I think the take is,
I might have had somebody affiliated with an equipment brand say that to me today.
And that's
that Augusta National is an example of why you shouldn't roll it back. That's hilarious.
I really do believe
that's such a like timeless memo talking point.
I want to say that I think it was a joke.
Fair, but I do think that this tournament should be an insight into what elite professional golf looks like, and that we haven't seen much of it recently, and what it takes to put on such an elite test for the best golfers in the world. It takes an inordinate amount of resources, land. The land has to be there. You have to buy land. Like, that should be a huge takeaway for people from this championship.
Yeah. One thing you didn't hit on was like extraordinary golf design too.
Sure.
Like, that should not be forgotten. Like, all the resources, everything, what Augusta National started with was a great golf course that continues to be a great golf course. And, you know, they're just, it's just such a, I mean, what's amazing about it is, like, I just don't think you can really hide anything, especially over the course of the entire tournament. What you don't want to do, you're eventually going to have to do out there. We talked on the shotgun start a little bit, like, is Pinehurst similar? I think Pinehurst is a great test, but like, you saw that Keimer could putt his way around there without having to chip. At Augusta, like, you can't survive without chipping. If you could, Lee Westwood would have like four Masters wins. And I think, like, if you think about, like, the players, like, I thought Morikawa got a little bit exposed today. I thought Max Homa he had his best major championship performance, but on the weekend, it was very clear he didn't have the horsepower to keep up with Scotty. And I think the only one that was standing there at this point, and I think like other players, if they were in better form, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, could have hung in the similar situation with Ludwig. But how many players in this field do you think could have gotten to 11 this week if they were playing great?
Yeah, I mean that's the thing about Scotty is that his great is a pretty high bar to clear for anybody else, even if they're super hot. You know, an example of what you're talking about that I saw during the play on Sunday, the kind of complete test that Augusta National gives, is on the 13th hole, where really in order to attack that hole, you need to hit some kind of right to left shape off the tee. Scotty steps up there and he never, like, his ball doesn't like move a lot with his driver, but he's able to kind of get it to nudge in one direction or the other. He nudged it to the left on 13 and got in a good position. Colin Morikawa stepped up there and hit a fade. Just like really tight along that left tree line and managed to sneak it into the fairway, but it was clear like the margin was very, very slim for that shot, and that was the shot he had. He wasn't going to be hitting a draw even on that hole. And, you know, I think that that kind of thing is sort of why we saw Morikawa falter today, because he just didn't quite have the array of answers that Scotty did.
And Garrett, on that, I think we talk so much about curving the ball right to left and how important that is off tees at Augusta. You also have to be able to do that on some of your iron shots. Like, I think the 11th hole, the approach shot into 11, is a great example of where you do need to turn it from right to left, because if you try to hit some kind of cut, that you can come over the top, pull it left into the water, or hit some kind of wipey shot way short right. The best players at playing on that hole hit a hard long iron draw that starts a little bit right of that green. So I think there's just so many instances of variety on this golf course.
Colin Morikawa said in his post presser, he said just about this, what you guys are talking about, but to see what he's doing with his irons is crazy impressive, because he's hitting every shot. He's moving both directions, and it's something that I admired, that hopefully I can get my game back to that kind of spot.
He's talking about Scotty.
I mean, you're talking about...
He's talking about Scotty, yeah. And he's not there. That's what he's saying. I'm not there right now, which is kind of an amazing admission.
And you're talking about a guy that is probably one of the three or four, like, you, I would say Scotty, Tiger, Zalatoris, Colin Morikawa. Those are like the four people on the planet that are the best at hitting irons.
Brooks.
And he's like, how many times in his life has Colin Morikawa been like, you know what, that guy's a better iron player than me?
I mean, yeah, clearly he couldn't have said that a couple of years ago when Morikawa was far and away the best iron player in the world. But also something to keep in mind here is that Morikawa has two majors, and he's talking about Scottie Scheffler like he's Superman.
Roughly the same age, two majors. I think they're a year apart in age. They have the same amount of majors, about the same amount of PGA Tour wins too. But I think like something that, you know, I'm probably more guilty than anybody on the planet at banging on the players. I'm going to steal your take, Garrett. What if the players is worth a half a major? Then Scotty's at three. It feels like Scotty's at three.
It does. Yeah, I'd still stand by that take. I think if you work out the numbers, if you go through the history of the players and apportion the half majors accordingly, that you'll get a lot of numbers that kind of make sense for people like, you know, Adam Scott, and in this case, Scottie Scheffler. So,
because that's the thing, these guys have like basically the same resume if you don't do that, and then it's like, but that doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right. Yeah. But, you know, Scotty has gone. It's funny how this run is so similar to the run that he went on in 2022. And so it just generates this extra question of, is the putter going to hang together? Are we going to see this run extend beyond the length of run that we've seen from Scheffler before and the length of run that we've seen recently from players like Jon Rahm, you know? Where for about 6 months, guy's unbelievable. and then regresses a little bit. Scottie Scheffler did the same thing at the beginning of 2022. And so how confident are we that he's going to keep this rolling?
Well, Garrett, this is the beauty of golf. The beauty of golf is that when you have it going, you never think it's going to leave.
Yep.
And then when you don't have it, you think you're never going to find it again. So this is like just the pure essence of golf, and us as commentators fall so often into the trap of A, writing people off when they don't have it. Oh, he's done. He may never get it. And I think like a lot of people probably are feeling that way about like Rory McIlroy right now, Jordan Spieth, where they feel like they're a little bit not there, even though Rory like has had two of the closest calls in the last 2 years of winning majors. On the flip side, you also get in this place where it's like, you know, Scotty may never lose again. He might do the Grand Slam. And I think after watching this, like, what is Scotty's odds opening up at Valhalla? Like, is he going to, I mean, he was 4-1 this week. So he was 4-1. These are like the highest odds that we've ever seen, or lowest, I guess would be lowest odds we've ever seen really since Tiger. Joseph, what do you think odds wise we're looking at Valhalla? Is it, are we going to get to like Tiger famously, like the even money stuff was nuts. Are we getting to like 2-1 or 3-1?
I think we could potentially get, if we were to play this Masters over again, I think he could be like maybe 2-1. Augusta is a low variance golf course in a smaller field. I would guess at Valhalla, he'll be like 4-1. That would be my guess. In an open championship, you have the wind, you have wave splits. I think we're going to see a lot of Scottie Scheffler in the 4-5-1 range. And then maybe if he's in form coming into Augusta next year, back down to like 2-3-1, which is crazy. Those are numbers that I didn't even really think was going to be in store for anybody over the past couple of years. But I think those will realistically be, I'd be shocked if he gets lower than 2-1 at any tournament. If he does, I mean, that's just completely bananas.
I think like if you were wanted to like kind of dig in on Scottie, and like any like potential robot, like I think the putting's the one thing that people are going to look at and say like this could hold him back. But like, I mean, life is easy for Scottie Scheffler right now. He's having a kid though. Like, you know, like I'm not saying like the kid's gonna ruin, but like you just think about like golf's really easy when your life's really easy. If that gets like it all like makes it, it's just going to be different. You're going to be, and it can be like, I think like kids sometimes make golfers better. So this could make him even better. But it is just another variable for Scotty to deal with. Like, I don't think I think it's going to be a great moment for him. And like, I'm very happy for him, you know, but like that will be a question of like, you know, how do you handle being a father and a pro golfer? Pro golf is like very, like, it's about being very unselfish, and it's a individual personal pursuit.
You mean it's about being very selfish?
Yeah, very selfish. My bad. But yeah, so that's something that you have to like possibly put in there. I don't think it's going to affect him, but it is just another variable.
Andy, thanks for coming on the pod. I'm going to let you get back to a little bit of writing here.
All right. Thanks, Garrett.
Joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, where he is in his hotel room after a spectacular week of calling the action on the featured groups stream on masters.com, is of course Shane Bacon. Shane, how are you doing, buddy?
Good, long week, fun week, best week of my year. It's been my favorite golf tournament for a long time. I mean, I balance it with the Open every year. I think we would get to July, it ends up being the Open, but it was a great week. I have a takeaway from this week, and I think a part of it is the guy I watched today. So we had Neil Shipley in the group with Tiger, right? The low amateur. And I talked to him on Tuesday, and I remember I walked away from it, and he was really confident. And he had this extreme, he wasn't nervous. Like I interviewed him for Ping. We did like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or something. He was super chilled out. He was really easygoing. And then he goes out there and he plays well in the first round. And I was not surprised by that. Then he makes the cut, which the cut was pretty high. He played solid enough to make the cut. That's good. You know, the cut at the Masters is impossible to make, but he played well. But we have him on Sunday, and he's playing with Tiger. And first thing first is he goes up to Tiger at the range and said what's up to him, which I thought was amazing. I mean, what 23-year-old kid would do something like that? And then he misses a five-footer on one. And I was like, all right, well, like, this kid's going to shoot 90. You know, it's fine. Like, it's fine if he shoots 90. It happens. I mean, people, it's a big moment. There's a lot of people around. And then he played the next 17 holes even par. And my takeaway between this kid who's still an amateur that's going to turn pro and then Ludwig in his first major is literally in contention with seven holes to play. This youth thing is serious business right now. And Scotty is the best golfer in the world. But, you know, you get this sense right now that there's a changing of the guard on the PGA Tour. And Jordan played awful this week. JT played bad, bad, bad. Down the street, it's the weirdest miscut maybe in Masters history, right? These guys that we expect to be playing well at this time in their career are just not as good as this young crop. And I am so impressed by the confidence, the composure, the way these young dudes aren't scared of anything and just want to go out there and play good golf. I just feel like this is the start of it. And there's going to be more of these dudes that are 20 and 21 and 22 that are uber talented and expect to be good right away. And that's my takeaway is Scotty is here and the next layer is below him much, much further down. But Shipley and Ludwig aren't the only guys that are going to be available here at this age. We are going to get more and more of these dudes that are unbelievable at 20, 21 years old that are going to potentially win majors at that age, you know?
Do you think that we'll start to see guys turning pro earlier as these returns keep coming in for guys who are 20, 21, 22 years old? Ludwig is 24. I mean, having this kind of success in your early 20s, kind of a new thing. So are we seeing a change here with when guys turn pro, do you think?
I think there's a chance you might see people turn pro a little bit earlier. I mean, you know, like you look at somebody like Joaquin Niemann. I mean, he's played in five Masters. He's 25 years old. You know, I mean, he turned pro early and, you know, he's obviously developed into a really good player. My point is more the young guys not needing a year or two to feel comfortable in what they're trying to do. It feels like they arrive at a stage and there isn't a fear of anybody. And I think that's more my point versus like there's going to be 17 and 18 year old kids that maybe play in a US Open or play in a big moment event. Not all of them, but there'll be a couple of them that play extremely well and like potentially might win. I just feel like this sport is getting younger because they're teaching this kind of hard ass view of who you are. And even if you're smiling and chilling out, like Ludwig's ability to just stay in the moment is a veteran thing to learn. And he's 24.
Shane, I feel like with Jordan Spieth and some of his peers, we sort of had a similar conversation. Like some of these young guys are really coming out ready to win right away. Do you feel like this is different, or do you think every, you know, 5 to 8 years, we're just going to cycle through a new crop of these young, talented players? Maybe careers are going to get a little bit shorter. Does this feel different to you?
I think it feels different because of the skill set that the young guys have. Jordan Spieth's skill set was he was able to golf better than everybody else. But golf, as you know, Joseph, more than anybody, golf has changed so much that it's power, power, power. It's learn how to hit it dead straight in 330. And if you can do that consistently, you can kind of learn the other stuff. And I just feel like being able to hit it past everybody you're playing with gives you this kind of, machismo or whatever you want to call it, that you're equal to or better than X. And, you know, like, I mean, these like Christo played with these pros the other day. He's hitting it 370. Like he doesn't know how to golf better than they do, but he knows that when he sees what they're able to do, he can learn it pretty quickly because he's got this incredible jumping ability or, you know, this fastball that nobody can catch up with. And it's like you throw it 105 or whatever, I'll teach you how to throw a curveball, you know?
Yeah. You know, as it pertains to Ludwig, everything he says Everything he does is state of the art. He is a product of all these advances that we've seen recently in golf instruction, how to swing, how to approach the game mentally, how to really do everything in a big time golf tournament to put yourself in a position to win. The way he talks about his approach is just spot on, right? And a lot of these guys are like that. They grew up with that. And that's just such a huge advantage.
Do you think that 10, 15 years from now, we're still going to talk about experience at Augusta the same way that we do now? Or do you think that the narrative is going to change to where these young golfers are so ready to play, Shane, that experience, they're going to learn within a year or two what they need to do on this golf course? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I remember this earlier in this week, I was talking to somebody and I said, this crop of first timers is so good. I would not be shocked if one of them won. And I mean, this was four or five names. I mean, Højgaard played great for whatever, 38, 40 holes or whatever the case may be. It's these guys were right there. And it, you know, like, it, yeah, they don't need to spend like 6 months talking to somebody about the golf course. It's like, oh, I can get here in two and I just hit it on the green. And if I three putt, whatever, it's just the power game. You know, what's so crazy, Joseph, is I've been doing featured groups now, I think for 4 years. I saw one person lay up on three, and it was actually the amateur. It's the only iron I saw hit on three for the week. 3 years ago, calling this tournament, it would be 50-50. It, you know, I mean, I don't have the data to back it up, but just by my memory, like, it would be, you'd have three guys on a tee and one or two of the guys would hit iron every round. And like literally one dude this week did it. You know, it just, it's crazy that it feels like it's turned this much this fast. But, you know, you look at what Max Homa didn't do on Sunday, right? He kind of scaled back on a couple swings that he wasn't comfortable with, and he couldn't get to the par fives and two. These guys kind of don't do that, you know? I mean, for better or worse, like, even if they make a bad swing, I don't really think it bothers them that much. I mean, Bryson, in a way, is the first level of this. But the thing about Bryson, too, is Bryson was this brilliant golfer that leaned into the power thing. These kids are just power from the start.
All right, Shane, we'll send you out of here. But
sorry about my wife.
Oh, no, no problem. We made it through. But one more question before you go. Since you were on the featured groups stream this whole week, and great job, by the way. You guys always kill it on that. It's a lot of fun to listen to. Great kind of way to wake up on the weekend in particular. But was there a moment during your coverage that you think maybe didn't get enough play, but really struck you in some way?
Did you guys see did they show on the main telecast the video when Rory popped Harry in the face or no?
I was watching the Amen Corner feed, I believe, when that came up. I'm okay. Not sure that ever made it to the main feed. That was funny.
Oh, that was awesome. I mean, he smoked him in the face. Garrett, he pulled a club. I think it was on 15 or maybe 13 or something. And just absolutely just mashes Harry in the face, just straight uppercuts him. And it was just so funny because you could see they were so focused on this shot and they just both broke, you know, and it was a pretty good moment. So it was funny. Our producer was auto replay on that. He's like, well, let's see that again. And I was like, nice, dude. So that's a not very serious moment, but God, it made me laugh a lot.
Shane, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Great to hear from you as always.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Joseph and I are back to do our final segment, recommendations. Joseph, what are you recommending this week?
I'm super psyched for the NBA playoffs, Garrett. Starts this week. We have the play-in games on Tuesday and Wednesday night. The NBA has kind of tweaked their format a little bit with their season over the last few years, and this play-in format has worked out super well for them. They're really exciting games, and then you launch right into the rest of the playoffs. So, like, I'm setting a clock to the Tuesday and Wednesday night games. I can't wait. So we got a lot of good
to win
playoff basketball coming.
Catch me up here. I haven't followed. Nuggets, you think, are still favored?
Nuggets. I mean, Nuggets, really good chance the Nuggets are coming out of the West. That's my pick to come out of the West. And then the Celtics are the clear favorites to come out of the East. So there's a good chance we'll get another Nuggets-Celtics rematch. But the West is much deeper, so you could it's a little more up in the air on the West.
I saw the Nuggets live. My son and I went to a Trailblazers game, and Trailblazers games these days are really about going to see the other team, unfortunately. But we got to see the Nuggets, and they are kind of a magical basketball team. Just, you know, what Jokic does is so unique. I've never seen a player like him. And just watching the way he kind of conducts the floor on offense is fascinating.
Garrett, sorry not to interrupt you, but last year I wanted to dig this up. I wrote a thing for Fried Egg about how Scheffler reminds me of Jokic. Does that resonate with you at all from watching him in person? I just feel like the distinct skill set, it doesn't look,
yeah,
it can look a little, yeah, bit funky, but they're absolutely, right, magical. They have size.
They're both,
and finesse.
Yeah, and they both kind of have that blocky build to them. That's what's really clicking for me right now, is that, like, although, yeah, obviously Jokic is a lot bigger by a scale of a lot, they're geniuses, and they, you know, Scheffler, kind of compared to most golfers, is kind of like a bigger and heftier build. But what's so cool about his game, right, is his hands. And that kind of is like Jokic, where the guy just takes up so much space, right, on the floor. You look at him, he's the biggest dude on the floor. But what makes him special is like the little touch things that he does. Yeah,
the passing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like, you wouldn't expect Scheffler to have as good a short game as he has, maybe, and you wouldn't expect Nikola Jokic to be one of the best passers in the history of the NBA. So I feel like there's a
Love
connection
that.
There. All right, what do you
recommend? My recommendation is an odd one, because I'm not recommending something I like here, but I just want, okay, to get people to watch this thing and, like, vibe with me about it. Like, get back to me about what you think. The movie You've Got Mail, the rom-com starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan from the late 90s, about two people who kind of hate each other in real life, but are secretly conducting a kind of romantic type thing over email. I watched this movie a couple of days ago, expecting kind of a comfort watch. I hadn't seen it in maybe about 20, 25 years. Whenever it came out, I watched it then and hadn't watched it since. This might be the single darkest movie I've ever seen in my life. It is so dark and depressing. The central romance is full of kind of manipulation and gaslighting and just weird stuff. And then the overarching theme of the movie is basically about how corporations and the internet have ruined all of our lives. And so I think that's what this movie is about. And I can't decide if it's like a brilliant commentary by Nora Ephron on the downfall of civilization in the late 20th century, or if it's just this movie that's completely unaware of its own darkness. And I just would recommend that people check it out and come to their own conclusions about it. And maybe, you know, if you have your own impressions, get back to me about what you think. What do you think of that recommendation, Joseph? Has anything been recommended like that on this podcast before?
No, but that's the fun. Like, occasionally when we do this segment, somebody will tweet or like message me like, oh, I listened to that album you recommended, really liked it. I like this, hey, will you come commiserate, yeah, with me and tell me that you also hated this recommendation? This is a new brand, and I'm very,
yeah,
into it.
The funny
it.
Thing is, I'm not sure if I hate it or if I kind of respect it for being, right, this weird kind of, you know, trenchant commentary on society disguised as a fluffy romantic comedy. I'm not
sounds like, I, you're leaning, I think you're leaning,
I think I do hate it, actually. All right, Joseph. That's good for this episode. Thank you, as always, for joining me for the Masters Takeaway episodes. Always such a delight to do these with you, and make sure to get some sleep tonight.
Thanks for having me, Garrett. You too.
This episode of the Fried Egg Golf Podcast was produced by Matt Ruscius. This week of all weeks, Matt did a lot of hard work behind the scenes producing videos and other things. Cameron Hurtis did a great job taking photographs on site at Augusta National. A lot of the folks who work for Fried Egg Golf are not necessarily on the podcast and, you know, out in front, and do just wonderful work producing our content. And I want to make sure that people know about them because they do such great work. So that's my shout out for this outro. Thanks to the whole team. It was a great Masters. Thank you for listening to this episode out there. and we'll be back soon with another.